Let's talk about the healthcare system, the public health system, and the backdrop for all of this. Meg Fitzgerald is with us. She's a private equity investor, author of Ascending Davos, and a healthcare policy professor at Columbia University. Meg, it's always great to see you. I want to start, first of all, actually, by asking you about the early reaction to the Omicron variant, because what I have been wondering here is, have we learned any lessons globally over the past 18 months? And are we applying them correctly to the emergence of this new variant? In other words, things like travel bans, which haven't proved particularly effective in the past, are something that we are now seeing governments impose. Do you think that we're doing a good job globally so far?
No, probably not globally, but I think certainly in the U.S., I was elated this weekend to see a sense of calm, concern, but calm. You know, we know that the mutation on the spike protein and the speed through which this variant is ripping through South Africa is concerning. But we were very quick to say we don't know whether it would cause more severe disease. And so we kind of took a pause here, at least in the U.S., and I think some lessons were learned. I don't think it was the right call and somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction to shut down travel to Africa, especially when the variant has already escaped the continent. So lessons in some areas, not so much globally. And as we talked about on the show back in April, and by the way, we're not in April in the U.S. with regard to the virus, but we certainly are in Africa. 10% of that population is vaccinated. So closing down borders does not help them get through the virus. And as we've spoken before, we all don't get through this unless countries like Africa and other places get through it.
Meg, I think part of the bull thesis on stocks is that our healthcare system can handle address any variants that comes up. But as we come up against the latest, the mask mandate, and which may push health professionals, many out of the market or out of the services that they perform, how big a risk is that to us fighting any new variants?
I think it's one of the largest risks that we have in the healthcare system. There's labor shortages across the industry. I don't know one company that is not grappling with labor shortages. Even in the field of nursing, the highest level of exodus is happening in nurses that have been on the job less than a year. So I think we have a lot of data to collect on this variant and what it means for the system. But suffice to say, if we don't have staff to kind of take care of patients sick and ones that are healthy that have been pushing off surgery and normal procedures, we're going to have a lot to deal with in the next few years that go beyond just this 6 months.
Meg, what's very interesting about this whole story is that a lot of this has to do with vaccination rates in other countries as well, right? Here in the United States, we were already debating whether or not we're vaccinated enough, let alone a lot of these third world countries that might be the next epicenter for future variants as well. So how important is WHO policy? Because it seems like a lot of the fixation, at least here in the United States, is on what's happening domestically. Of course, that might just be Americentric policy just broadly. But how important is a global voice on all of this and getting global vaccination efforts up?
I think it's really important. You've got places in the world that are at 10%. You've got other places that are north of 70%. It's definitely driven by economics and those that have access to good care and medicine. So we can't have countries lingering at 10% and expect not to see a variant, right? So I think the WHO is trying their hardest to say, can we get everybody up to 70%? Other places are looking for 90%. And as we saw with, what's happening in the U.S., we quickly had to, recalculate what exactly is a full dose to make sure that everybody is now going to get their booster, because we know after one and two doses, your immunity wanes and it comes right back up with the booster. So I think global policy is really important. I just wish we were doing more to help countries like Africa on the ground. It's important to note they do now have quite a bit of vaccine. What they're grappling with is logistics and infrastructure. You're asking people to walk to get a vaccine or take a bus or miss work. They don't have cold chain capabilities. So in South Africa, they have about 5 months of vaccine supply. And the worry right now is that vaccine supply is going to go bad, that it's dated, it expires, or it doesn't remain cold. So I think we always have to think through the solution. Just because you dump vaccine somewhere doesn't mean that there's healthcare infrastructure to adopt it or be able to push it out.
Meg, let me go back to the vax mandate and those potential labor shortages. If we do get this rush of folks leaving the healthcare profession, where are the new people to come in? I'm not a doctor. I can't go to my local hospital and help the cause here. Where do these people come from?
I think let's hear it for the trade degree. Let's target people in high school, people that are out of work, and help support them to get two-year degrees to get into the healthcare system. The Biden administration allocated quite a bit of funding to do this. And I think we have to let people know it's okay to get a two-year degree and that you can have a long career. Right now, we're putting a Band-Aid on it by using staffing agencies, trying to bring in staff from outside the United States. Some places we're paying four times the rate, and that means staff is leaving their own hospital to job hop and make more money. That's a short-term solution. I think we need to look at healthcare as an important place to work. We need to think about degrees that support that. And we need to fund community colleges so people find this of interest. And also, by the way, affordable. Not everybody has $200,000 to go to college.
Yeah, definitely not. And I also wonder about the not just the sort of on the ground healthcare workers, but also public health workers as well. And people setting policies around the country. And what is really, it's to say it's not unified is an understatement, right? So I also wonder about the talent pool there and the sort of willingness to work as in a unified manner to attack these problems.
Yeah, for sure. Listen, you look at Israel, they're largely on one EHR system. Here in the United States, we have 40 to 50. So we're not unified in data. Therefore, we're not sharing information real time. So I think aside from the workforce being more unified, we're really asking them to do things manually. And it would be a lot better if we could share data real time. I also think this pandemic put public health on the map. In good and bad ways, but mostly good ways. I think people now see the importance of the job. Used to be something where we spent, 10 cents less or less on the dollar towards public health. And I think the private and public sector, certainly some of my folks in private equity are seeing that it's really important to invest in this because it affects all of healthcare. And it also affects the returns on all of their investments to make sure that you have a solid infrastructure, good surveillance, and that you're taking care of all the people, a population, and not just individuals.
Meg, really good point. Thanks for being here. Good to see you. Meg Fitzgerald is a private equity investor, author of Ascending Davos, and a healthcare policy professor at Columbia University. Appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to refocus on the effect of Omicron potentially on the markets and how it could be affecting JP Morgan's asset management division's outlook. Meera Pandit will be joining us next.
Before you know it, the calendar will read 2022, and who knows, at this rate, the S&P 500 may be down another 5% before that calendar turn happens. So how should you be positioned into the new year with stocks under major pressure right now? Lizanne Saunders is the chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab and joins us now. Lizanne, always nice to see you. We were just talking about the Federal Reserve's, I would say, hawkish shift yesterday, led by Fed Chair Jerome Powell. As you look towards next year, we could have an inflation-fighting Jerome Powell. Does that set the stage for below-average returns for stocks?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it really was such a hawkish shift. I think the announcement at the November FOMC meeting of the tapering starting, but the $30 billion a month just being for November and December, at least implicitly suggested the Fed was going to consider a faster pace of tapering. And that really started to get built into expectations until, of course, the news on Black Friday or Bleak Friday of Omicron. And the market made an adjustment then to move away from that further tightening. I think just what Powell did was more explicitly keep that on the table. So I'm not sure if it was a big shift. But yes, I think at this stage in the economic cycle, in the market cycle, the move from very loose policy to tighter policy, not tight policy, I think has been a factor in volatility. And you add that to an environment where we had started to see a tremendous amount of speculative froth again, and then add to that Omicron, you get this sort of double whammy catalyst that can sometimes cause an eruption in volatility when you have that excessive optimism and high level of complacency. So I think that's been the recipe for the kind of moves and shifts we've seen in the market.
Lizanne, as you pointed out in your 2022 outlook, we have seen a correlation between stock prices and bond yields really for the past several decades, right? So as we go into next year, are we going to continue to see that? Presumably yields are going to move up as the Fed does indeed taper and then raise rates. Are we going to continue to see that same sort of correlation?
So, I mean, I think that that's probably one of the more important aspects of the outlook that we put together. And keeping an eye on that correlation may end up being at least a partial answer to this question that's out there as to whether we're not just in a short-term inflation spike, but whether we're moving into a more secular inflationary backdrop. Because to the point about yields and stock price correlation, for 30 years, starting in the late 60s, those were negatively correlated. And as a reminder, when bond yields are going down, bond prices are going up, which meant that the returns in bonds and stocks moved in the same direction. So diversification, at least across those two asset classes, became more difficult. Then for the 20 years, starting in the late 90s, we've had a positive correlation between bond yields and stock prices. A couple months ago, we dipped back into negative territory. We popped back out. But if we moved back into negative territory and stayed there for a somewhat sustainable period of time, I think that could send a message that the secular backdrop is changing. We know that that 30-year period of negative correlations was an environment of obviously higher inflation, but greater frequency of supply shocks versus the past 20 years that has been more prone to demand shocks, albeit not terribly significant ones. So that is certainly something I'm keeping a close eye on in 2022. I don't have a forecast for whether that's going to happen, but I think were it to occur, that would be a pretty definitive sign that the backdrop has moved away from being disinflationary like the last 20 years.
And Lizanne, I would say, by the way, that's one of the charts that you have in your outlook for next year, which I encourage everyone to read. It's available. Anyone can read it on the Schwab website. And one of the other charts that caught my eye was about consumer expectations minus their present situation, how they feel right now, subtracted from how they expect things to be and whether that's a precursor for recessions. And we just were talking a few minutes ago on the show about the yield curve and that predictability for recessions. You're looking at this one. I mean, the right side of this chart doesn't look so great on that front. So what is the likelihood that we're going to enter another recession?
Well, one caveat with a statistic like this, and it's not to suggest it's no longer important, but and yes, you can see based on those gray bars, which are recessions, that never in the history of this data have we been at this low a spread. And it did pop up yesterday with the release of consumer confidence, but not by much. We've never been at this level without it being a precursor to a recession. But of course, you add into the mix now the virus and variant news, Delta, now Omicron, as a factor, maybe putting more downward pressure on future expectations than has been the case in the past, where it's really been more about economic conditions that we're putting downward pressure. So it could be a bit different this time. And I think in terms of the yield curve, yes, it has been flattening, but it's nowhere near the point of threatening an inversion, which has historically been another pretty strong recession indicator, but with some lead time. So I think we need to be on watch for these things in 2022, but it's not on the basis of having a recession view. But I think it's time to start pulling out the indicators and at least kind of keep them on your mental checklist because of where we are in admittedly a very unique cycle.
Hey, it's Brian here. And kind of drilling down on the consumer side of things, what are you seeing in terms of the behavior for the shift between goods and services? Because another call that we have been hearing earlier in 2021 was, well, as the virus gets contained, you're going to see that shift from goods to services, which hasn't necessarily happened. Is it because people just don't want to get out of whatever system they put up for their pandemic haircuts?
Well, we saw a divergence in the two, and particularly during the shutdown for obvious reasons, we saw a massive surge in demand and consumption on the goods side at the early stage of the pandemic. That, of course, was because most on the services side was shut down. So we didn't have access to consumption on the services side. So it all filtered into goods. We had started to see a bit of a convergence between the two as we went through the reopening phase, but it's been with fits and starts, especially because of the Delta variant, which didn't cause lockdowns, but it does change behavior with regard to services. We don't have enough detail on Omicron to know whether we're going to go through the same type of hit to services demand or consumption, but we may have arrested that convergence for now, at least as we wait to get more details. It's been our view, though, that if demand does shift more definitively to services and services remain open and available for everybody, that it wouldn't be additive to goods consumption, that it would take from goods consumption because goods consumption has been so strong. We're not meeting that demand from a supply chain standpoint, but we're well above trend line, suggesting that we're more likely to see an ease. And if you look at things like buying intentions, whether it's for homes or autos or large household durables, those have absolutely plunged because prices are so high, it's putting some downward pressure on demand. But until we have more information on Omicron and what restrictions get put in place at the global level, it's going to be hard to make a judgment on what those trends look like, at least in the near term.
Really enjoyed your Outlook piece. And again, as Julie mentioned, you can read more about it on the Schwab website. Lizanne Saunders, Chief Investment Strategist at Charles Schwab. Manscaped has been tidying up male groin since 2016, and now it's looking to add some tidy profits to your stock portfolio. The consumer products company plans to go public by merging with a SPAC dubbed Bright Lights Acquisition Corp in a deal expected to close in the first quarter of next year. Manscaped is being valued at $1 billion, aka unicorn status, as the company has also pushed into new growth areas such as ball spray toner, ball wipes, and anti-chafing ball deodorant. Let's dive into the company with its founder, Paul Tran. Paul, I don't mean to giggle at me, but these are some of the names you have given to these products. I am not pulling this stuff out of thin air. But Paul, ultimately, good to see you here. What do you view as your competitive advantage?
Brian, great to be here. Thank you for having me. Well, the competitive advantage is we make phenomenal products, and we tapped into a market that was underserved. Before Manscaped, nobody was talking about male groin. There was no brand. But now, fast forward to about 3 years later, we're now the de facto standard for male groin care. And, you know, many people see our ads, they see our commercials, but nobody knows how fast we've grown during that amount of time. So we went from a $3 million TTM to almost $300 million in revenue in just 3 years, with only $23 million of capital raised while being profitable and amassing over 1 million active members.
Hey, Paul, Brian Chung here. So why go down the SPAC route here, right? I guess we know your kind of growth trajectory. You have all these new products. Why'd you ultimately decide to team up with the SPAC sponsor that you did? And what do you hope to use the capital that you're going to raise to do? Are there other types of categories, maybe even outside of the male category, to expand into?
Well, great question, Brian. For us, it was a dream to build the next multi-generational brand. That's what we set out to do. And to do that, we believe that we had to be a public entity. We wanted our 1 million members to also be owners. And to answer your question, why the SPAC route? It's because we found the perfect SPAC partner. We wouldn't have gone down the SPAC route if we didn't find the perfect SPAC partner. Like, for example, you have on the screen here, I mean, Bright Lights brought us Channing Tatum. They are experts in that channel. And so beyond just a check, a really large check, which we didn't really need because we were already profitable, they added a lot of value. And that's why we chose the SPAC route.
Yeah, Channing Tatum is a pretty perfect person to think of when you think of something like this, given his films. Paul, it's Julie here. And I want to ask just in terms of how these products are specific for this use case. In other words, like, can a guy just buy a Gillette and do the same thing? You know, in terms of your moat for these types of products, how do you think about it? And how do you make that value proposition and pitch to consumers?
Well, I'm going to get pretty technical here. And, you know, we create products and the interesting thing is that we've grown way beyond the groin. So you know, we started in the groin, we dominated, but we now cater to the entire male body. So we have products for hair, we have products, you know, deodorant that's going to be coming out, lip balm for men. And it's very, they're all very specifically designed. For example, our trimmer electronic products was created specifically to remove hair on loose skin. And for men, that is a problem area. There wasn't a trimmer designed specifically around that use case. So there is a lot of IP around how we actually do that. And so we see that as a competitive moat. In addition to that, you know, our brand voice and the way that we honestly and authentically speak to men, we believe that is an incredible moat as we expand into now 38 countries into retail. We have the ability to speak directly to men rather than go through a retailer. Because we're digitally native. And you know, in addition to that, we're actively deploying over $100 million in branding and marketing. We're the official sponsors of the San Francisco 49ers. We're the sponsors of the UFC. We aim to be really, we want to be really authentic to men, and we want to create phenomenal products.
Okay, so but that's an interesting point because, you know, to Julie's point about why couldn't you just use a regular razor, I think a lot of this has to do with brand awareness because people aren't Googling looking for a trimmer specific to men that has the characteristics of the things that you're using to differentiate the product. And a lot of people, including myself, have seen your ads already. I think I even saw a video. You're very self-aware. There's a video of seniors reacting to Manscaped ads, and there's even a long version of it apparently on YouTube. Tell us about your marketing spend. How much of an expense is that to the company? Because it does seem to be pretty important to your business model.
Yeah, so marketing used to be a higher percentage of revenue, but as we scaled so quickly, marketing spend as a budget has scaled tremendously. We're now actively deploying $100 million in media, but as a percentage of revenue, it's decreased, and that's exactly what we're looking for. We're building an international multi-generational brand. That takes capital, but what's special about us is we're able to recycle that capital so quickly. So instead of raising hundreds of millions of dollars, we've only raised $23 million while being profitable. And after this transaction, 100% debt-free with close to probably, with barring any redemptions, $200 million on the balance sheet. The media for us is a way for us to talk to men. You know, and traditionally, you know, traditional players have to go through a retailer. They talk about their value propositions on their packaging. We use media, we use influencers, we use the, you know, the, all of our platforms, including TikTok and Instagram, to speak directly to men, to let them know that, you know, women led the way in this hygiene behavior, and now men are following, and it's okay. Right. It's perfectly fine to talk about it. It shouldn't be a taboo topic. And if you're going to do it, you know, use the right tools for the job.
Oh, I'm on the website right now, and I'm looking at this product called Ball Spray Toner. What is the origin story of a product like that? What are you hearing guys come to you and say, hey, folks at Manscaped, what do I need right now? And what are some of the new use cases you're hearing from people?
Yeah, so that product fits in line with how we think about solving these problems for men. And it is all about routines. It's not any singular product. And if you look at how we approach solving these issues for men, it is around an entire routine. And for example, in the groin, that routine covers the hair removal, which is our lawnmower series of products. You know, our crop preserver, which is a kind of a wet deodorant for that area. And of course, our boxers. So we think about it as an entire routine. What's really interesting is that, you know, we made one pair of Manscaped boxers for a content piece, and men wrote in asking us whether you can buy Manscaped boxers. So we've now deployed 2 million Manscaped boxers into the market. Now, we're not an apparel company, but we're really proud that men are willing to wear our brand on their bodies. And so we realize that we're quickly becoming a lifestyle brand that has the permission to extend and take care of men from head to toe. And you see that in our active million members.
Paul, you have one really interesting story. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you founded the company.
Well, I've always been an entrepreneur. I'm an immigrant here, and came over when I was about 5 years old. To this great nation. I love being an entrepreneur in this amazing country. And I started always started businesses, and it was Manscaped that it was looking at the male body and going from head to toe. You realize that there was a brand and a product for every single need that you can think of, but there was white space in the groin. And so the hypothesis was either dudes weren't practicing this hygiene behavior, or there was no market for it. And, once you start creating products for it, you quickly realize that there's a huge market for it. We've deployed 4 million trimmers in the last 3 years and with hundreds of millions in revenue. But if you think about it, there's over 80 million men in the US, 40 million millennials. And globally, there's 900 million men. So the target demographics for just self-care and growing care alone is massive. But that's only one of our verticals. We also have a really large suite of consumable products, which has been scaling tremendously also.
I will look forward to following your public company journey. Manscaped founder Paul Tran, good to see you. We'll talk to you soon.
Sales of non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, are expected to surge to more than $17 billion this year alone, at least according to Cointelegraph Research. A new fund is looking to take advantage of that craze with the launch of the first NFT-themed ETF trading under the ticker symbol NFTZ. Let's bring in Sylvia Jablonski. She's Defiance ETF's co-founder and CIO. Sylvia, it's good to talk to you today. Talk to me about the structure of this new ETF, because it offers exposure. That's kind of the key word. It's about companies who are in the space, not necessarily the NFTs.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me. Super excited about this one. So you're absolutely right. So there are sort of two ways to buy NFTs. One is to buy them directly in a digital marketplace. And the second one that now exists is our ETF. And the way that you get exposure to NFTs through our ETF is that we essentially have an index methodology that selects securities that are involved in the issuance, the creation, and the commercialization of NFTs. So companies that are basically investing in the NFT space in a huge way and are representative of the growth of NFTs and will sort of benefit from that growth over time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious how you kind of landed on these, because it's tricky, right? NFTs are so new, So it's like, you could put a Playboy in here, which is one of the top holdings, because they've issued their own NFTs. But you think about some of, I guess, the infrastructure there, or some of the big players like an OpenSea, obviously not a public company. So, I mean, how did you kind of weigh some of these that got included? Because it looks like there's a heavy emphasis, too, on mining companies, Bitcoin mining companies, that don't necessarily seem directly linked to NFTs.
Yeah, so great question. So this is actually the Defiance Digital Revolution ETF, and there are different components to the NFT marketplace. NFT is one of the core holdings and sort of the core exposures of this fund. So to answer your question, we look at companies like, as you said, Playboy, because they have generated a good amount of revenue from these iconic NFTs that they, had a couple of weeks ago. You've got companies like Atari in there that are, huge in NFTs, whether it's for the old school gaming console, or it's for some of their games, and also they're a big landowner in the metaverse and might have NFT relevance in terms of land ownership, kind of popping up on the blockchain there. You've got Funko; they've made their world famous figurines into NFTs. Mattel is selling NFTs of some of their big cars. So these companies are, we try to think about purity. We want investors to have access to companies that are really investing in the NFT space, really creating and commercializing these products. And I think you're going to be hard pressed to find some of these names in other ETFs out there. To address the other question about you know, why do you see some blockchain names in there and things like that? Well, you know, all of there's a huge relevance to NFTs. The trading, exchanging of NFT happens on Ethereum. You know, blockchain technology drives the NFT participation, trading and selling. So all of that is relevant. In order to buy NFTs, essentially, you know, you're hooking up your digital wallet to one of these platforms that you mentioned, OpenSea and Rarible, and you're exchanging cryptocurrency to buy and sell NFTs. So it's all part of the digital revolution ecosystem. And the second point I would make there is this is a fairly new space. So we're really the first ones getting into this on the ground up. And like, again, just trying to find the purest legitimate names that are publicly listed. So as you see more companies enter the space, you know, the index methodology would naturally sort of end up picking them up if they fit the standards of commercializing, investing, and creating NFTs.
What kind of take-up have you seen so far? I mean, to the point you made, this is still really new. There's a lot of investors out there who are maybe not, you know, ready to invest directly. It feels like an ETF like this, it really is about kind of narrowing the divide a little, maybe. But, you know, can you talk a bit more about that for those who don't want to invest directly? They're not as familiar. You know, what does this ETF offer?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think what's been really cool about ETFs in the past few months, particularly with the launch of some of the cryptocurrency related products that came out, is that it's sort of democratizing access to digital assets and cryptocurrency to the masses. So you're right. A lot of people have no idea how to set up a digital wallet or just aren't comfortable trading, you know, direct in terms of buying Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, Polygon, whatever it might be, NFTs. And so they're going to miss out on that. They might believe in those opportunities. They might like to speculate. They might like to invest for the future because they think it's going to grow, but they're not really looking to enter that digital world direct. So, you know, the closest thing you can do and in a sort of, you know, cost efficient, transparent way, so you don't have like a 2%, you know, platform fee to trade this. It's a management fee of 65 bips is you buy this ETF and you get exposure to names that have a strong exposure to the NFT theme and you know, buy and sell them in your stock trading account as you would any other sort of equity or ETF. So I think it's really cool to have different versions of products out there. You know, you have it with Bitcoin, whether you can buy the Bitcoin, you can buy the futures, you can buy the ETF that uses futures to track the price. Same thing here. You can buy an NFT or you can buy NFTZ.
Yeah, and 65 bips, you know, not as high as some of the other things we've seen out there, too. And you know, NFTs, it sounds like you're going to have to rebalance this one a bit, depending on what pops up and what opportunities pop up. But in terms of maybe direct exposure, you know, we have seen kind of fractionalization start to come into the NFT space. I'm thinking about the Beeple NFT that really shot all this out there in the mainstream when we saw that painting, or GIF rather, sell for more than $60 million. So like that was a piece of fractionalizing some of this. But when you look at maybe direct ownership here, curious if you own any of these NFTs directly, if you've seen any projects that you've been excited by, or if you're kind of tapping into that directly now too.
Yeah. So, you know, when we started talking about this as a firm in terms of launching it, that, you know, there was just so much interest in the space and the Beeple news came out. So, you know, I did go out and buy an NFT. Actually, I ended up buying my little son a Mattel NFT because I thought I should have that experience. Right. And it was really cool. It's sort of a creative thing. What's really neat about NFTs is that it's sort of different than investing in the stock market and investing in a company. Right. If I invest in whatever company it is, I buy the stock price. If the company does well, the stock price goes up, I make money, great. But this is a little bit different. If I invest in an NFT, I can actually co-create with the creator. I can have this relationship with the creator where I determine the future path of that artwork. I have input into that artwork. I can participate in chat rooms and talk about, you know, like why we did what we did and things like that. So I think it's a cultural revolution in that, you know, it's really showing the purity of the sharing economy between the investor and the creator. So yeah, I mean, I'm super interested in it myself. I think it's going to be a massive growing space. The growth of the metaverse really put this on the map, I think, 100-fold, because, you know, you're going to need NFTs basically to go to concerts in the metaverse, to own land, to represent the fashion choices you have, to trade art, music, you know, codes for meetings, things like that. So I just think it's absolutely going to blow up, and it's a really fun thing to participate in.
Sylvia Jablonski, Defiance ETF's co-founder and CIO. Good to talk to you today.
Welcome back. We got a jobs report this morning that, at least on the headlines, missed estimates if you look at the non-farm payrolls, but then had a better than estimated unemployment number of 4.2%. And we've had a lot of folks sort of digging under the surface of this report and saying it's a murkier picture than it maybe at first blush appears. Let's get some more clarity, hopefully, now from Secretary Marty Walsh. He's the Labor Secretary of the United States. Mr. Secretary, it's always good to see you after we get these reports. What do you make of the numbers on balance? Because you do seem to have some sort of cross current here.
Certainly, when you look at this jobs report, 210,000 jobs, I look at all of the reports together. I mean, obviously the forecast was for higher numbers. And if you look at that and look where we are today, certainly numbers different. But when I look at, since President Biden's taken office, we've added over almost 6 million jobs to the economy. The unemployment rate's 4.2%, which is a good projection. We saw areas like construction, manufacturing, transportation, the highest gains, significant gains in those areas, which is a very good number to see. But clearly, we know that in certain sectors of the economy, as far as people coming back to work, we still have work to do.
Mr. Secretary, wage inflation near 5% or 4.8% to be more exact. Is that a good number to you, or do you think wage gains are coming on too hard, too fast?
No, I mean, I think wage gains are good. I mean, I'm not going to stand in front of a camera and say that people earning more money is bad, but I certainly think that we're watching the inflation numbers well. The president has rolled out a plan to deal with inflation. Secretary Yellen is working, obviously, on inflation. The president made a move earlier the week, or maybe last week, about releasing some oil out into the market to bring the prices down. And we've seen in some of the job gains that we've seen, lower wage workers historically in the past, we've seen those workers get more money, and they're actually, in some cases, outpacing inflation. So certainly it's something that we're watching, keeping a close eye on, and working towards addressing.
Hey, Secretary Walsh, Brian Chung here. Wanted to ask specifically about the leisure and hospitality space, because the shortfall compared to pre-pandemic levels is still over a million payrolls. What does that tell you in terms of policy and making sure that the people who work in America's bars and restaurants can get back to work?
Yeah, you know, that's a number that I'm a little surprised about as well. I think obviously that has direct connection to the pandemic and people worried about it. And also, I'm not sure how the hiring is. That number is not where we want it to be. We saw some good growth in the beginning in the spring, if you remember, April, May, and June, if I'm correct. We saw some good numbers in the hospitality industry and the bar industry where people are coming back. And this month, we didn't see those same gains. So certainly that's an area we're keeping an eye on. And I know that historically, but that's been an area of a lot of conversation around wages.
Now, as I talked about at the beginning, you know, we are seeing this sort of disparate findings from the employment survey and the household survey, Secretary. And I wonder if the Department of Labor and the BLS sort of need to take another look at how that data is collected, or if there's any kind of review that you think needs to be done, given that we did see such disparate outcomes in the two surveys.
Well, I just think the whole world is a little upside down right now. And I think that when you think about surveying and reaching out to people, you think I mentioned this correlation yesterday, last month, to polling. Everything is different, more challenging right now. And certainly, when we went over the numbers today, the commissioner was very clear on the numbers. There were some minor adjustments, gains. There was a lot of participation this month in the surveys, which is a good thing. You know, I think that the number is that they're going to get the number up to like 83% of respondents. We're heading towards that direction. And I think that as we continue to move forward here, looking at these numbers moving forward, I think it's going to be a month-by-month basis.
And finally, Secretary, I do want to ask you about the Omicron variant. The message from the president has been very clear. He's taking steps, but he's telling people not to panic. There doesn't necessarily seem to be panic, but at the same time, do you expect any kind of psychological effects on hiring, for example, or on people's willingness to go back to work?
Well, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of psychological effects of the pandemic on a lot of people. And I don't think it's just about the Omicron variant. I think it's overall psychological impacts of COVID-19. And I think that we have to address that issue. And I think that, you know, I've said it as many times possible when I was the mayor and sometimes here as Secretary of Labor to people that are watching, you know, if you feel stressed, you feel concerned, go talk to somebody. This has been a very difficult time for a lot of people. Families have been concerned about their health. Families have lost loved ones. Families have lost their jobs. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. And I think that, you know, people need to take care of themselves. And I think the psychological impact of the virus, it'll be measured at some point and some smart person will talk about it. But I definitely think there's an impact of it.
It's a really good point. Secretary Marty Walsh, Labor Secretary of the United States, thank you so much for joining us. It's always good to get your perspective.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Earnings season has not been kind to some of the highest flyers that benefited from the pandemic lockdown trade. I'm thinking names like Zoom, Peloton, online education company Chegg, and now you can add DocuSign to that list as well, seeing a 40% decline after they reported earnings, the largest one-day decline in the company's history off that report. Even though it was a top and bottom line beat for DocuSign, but billings, which reflect future business under contract, coming in weaker than analyst expectations as well as their own for the quarter and the look ahead there. $565.2 million short of its own guidance at $585 million as well as $597, the range $585 to $597 as well as the analyst forecast of $594. And for more on all that and some of the return to normal here that we're seeing at companies like DocuSign, I want to bring in the CEO of DocuSign joining us here, Dan Springer, alongside Yahoo Finance's Brian Sozzi. And Dan, appreciate you coming on here. Obviously, the reaction, I think, as we were discussing in the break, a little bit more extreme than maybe you were expecting, given the fact that we've seen a lot of companies return to normal. And you've said that you saw customers start to return to normalized buying patterns. Talk to me about what you're seeing now as we maybe get back to normal.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in our situation, we were a strong high growth company before the pandemic, and the pandemic actually accelerated our growth, as we talked about it, as it was a demand for more digital transformation. And as we've been talking about for, you know, quarters and quarters now, that we know at some point we would see a moderation, you know, of the pandemic level demand. And our aspiration was to sort of have a nice sort of a slow landing, you know, back to the old high growth model that we had. In this situation, the first half, you know, we provided guidance that we actually thought we would start to see that softening in the first half. It didn't happen in the first half, but it hit us more dramatically here in H2. And I think that's what was, you know, concerning to investors or to analysts, that, hey, we weren't actually able to say how that landing, you know, was going to happen. So that's fundamentally what changed at DocuSign.
Dan, you mentioned on the call last night that customers didn't have that, I guess, the same sense of urgency. Why is that the case?
Well, I think, you know, when a lot of people found themselves when the pandemic hit saying, hey, there's a sort of key set of use cases, maybe it's sales contracts. And they used to have people, you know, mail those to people and walk them around or hand deliver them. They couldn't do that in the pandemic. So they quickly wouldn't be able to run their business. They couldn't get those agreements in place. So we saw some urgency of activity because of that. And that is one of the reasons our growth did, you know, accelerate significantly over the last six quarters from where it had been pre-pandemic. And I think the reality is that people had done that purchasing because they needed to get raised their digital transformation. And we feel that that impact, that positive impact to our business is now played out. And we're going to be back to the new normal, which I think will be a lot like the old normal. But that change and that shift was more dramatic. It didn't sort of play out over a couple of quarters. It hit us in the second half, you know, much more substantially than we thought it was. And that's why, you know, for the first time, as you indicated up front, we ever missed a guidance on any key metric as we did on billings.
At the same time, though, Dan, I mean, when you talk about what you're projecting for the fourth quarter here, the quarter to come, lower than expected revenue guidance as well as billings guidance. But we've talked a lot about issues around Omicron here, too. So I wonder in the short term if the earliest data you're looking at could potentially see a return to what you're describing there when people might not be back in the office if that gets pushed back.
Yeah. It's not our forecast that even if there were, you know, changes, there have been changes since the core, you know, hit that the whole economy took and the boost that, you know, that did for us. around the pandemic. And I don't think that is something that, we forecast anyway would have sort of another bump, if you will. We think that core thing that most of our customers needed to get in place, they've gotten those in place. And while we continue to add lots of new customers, we had 59,000 new customers in the last quarter. So it was a strong new growth. Our challenge has been more that we haven't done the good job we normally do on expanding our existing relationships. And going through this COVID period of that extra demand, we became a little more sort of demand meters, right? As opposed to demand generators. And so we need to switch back. And that's what we're focused on doing in the second half, is getting that activity back to the way we always used to run the business, which we drive great customer success. They get a high ROI from DocuSign. And we point out new use cases and growth areas where they can get more great benefit. So that's kind of the focus for us, you know, to get right now.
Dan, I think it says a lot about you as a leader to even be on here today. When we're running a graphic right next to you where your stock price is down 40%. And on the earnings call, you did own some of the missteps in the quarter here. So the question is, how do you get back to growing like we've come to know from DocuSign? Have you made some changes to the management team? Are you out there hiring more people? What's the plan?
Yeah, well, so on the first piece, you know, my mom always taught me, bring back a bad report card, you own it. But then you move past it and you get focused on the growth, just like you said, and improving what you need to do. And so that's what we're focused on doing right now. We did make some organizational, you know, sort of realignment that I thought would allow us to focus more aggressively on getting that go-to-market back, again, back to the old mode. It's what we've done for years of driving high growth here and building this fantastic franchise. So it's not like a new thing that we're doing, but it's just some increased focus. And the number one issue for us is we've grown so fast during the pandemic. You know, a huge portion of our field joined when the only mode they knew was customers calling us saying, could I please get more DocuSign and could I get DocuSign faster? And now we've got to go back and enable those new people and say, this is the way we've always built DocuSign. And we got to get back to that motion, again, of driving customer success, coming in, showing that they got a tremendous ROI and pointing out all the other, you know, use cases they have, more growth for them and a cross-sell opportunity for us. So that's what we're going to get back to. And I think you know, the changes we made will allow that to happen a little faster. And we want in the second half where we see that there's going to be, you know, this reduction in the landing post COVID to be the time when we turn that around. So if we go into the new year, we'll be able to move back to the way we used to grow the business.
You know, if customers, Dan, do have that, just have taken a step back in their sense of urgency, does that mean your total addressable market, has that shrunken compared to what you would have thought it would have been coming outside of the pandemic?
Yeah, it hasn't. Interestingly enough, we haven't changed our view on the TAM from pre-pandemic. When the demand got, you know, escalated, we never said that the TAM got bigger. We have always thought it was about a $25 billion e-signature TAM and about $25 billion for the rest of that DocuSign Agreement Cloud, the other products we talk about there. So from that standpoint, we didn't increase it during the pandemic. So we didn't think it was fundamentally anything that changed the core market opportunity. It just accelerated our path to, you know, achieving that TAM. So now coming out of the pandemic, I don't think anything has changed in the TAM in the other direction. It's still significant. Remember, we're going to do $2-ish billion of revenue this year, and we are the dramatic market share leader in the space. There's just no one else that's, you know, even a reasonable fraction of that. So when you start talking about a $50 billion TAM, it is lightly penetrated. This is very early days, and we are very bullish that we will continue, you know, to grow at attractive rates.
You know, Dan, I'd echo what Sazi said here in terms of you being on right now and owning the report card. And that's coming from a guy who's also had some tough report cards to own in his day as well. But I mean, when you look at the analyst reactions, Citigroup calling it one of the biggest whiffs they've seen in recent memory. We saw price targets cut from a few different analysts out there. But when you look at this, we were talking in break, you see this as an overreaction. I know CEOs don't like remarking on the price of their shares often, but you see it as an overreaction. You're putting your money where your mouth is. You're talking about buying here. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, again, most of the time when we get on, and by the way, for the almost 4 years as a public company, the vast majority of our, you know, reports have been quite solid, and that's why the company has grown so much and the value. We've had a, you know, fantastic run. When people ask me in the past, do you think your valuation is too high? Because, you know, multiples for SaaS companies are at historic rates. And I've always said, look, we can't really talk about the market. I don't know. That's not what we focus on. We focus on, you know, building a great company, building innovative products, driving great customer success, and we kind of think it'll take care of itself. I am surprised. I'll be straightforward with you. I do not see the reaction in the stock price to be commensurate with what I think is a much less dramatic business performance change. I've made two phone calls since I saw the reaction. First was to my general counsel, and I asked Chum, is there anything that stops me from buying stock? She said, as long as you wait till the window opens on Tuesday, you know, you haven't been selling shares, so therefore you can buy all you want. And the second one was to my financial manager and lined up the first $5 million of purchases. So if the stock doesn't dramatically increase, I'll be continuing to buy shares. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I like that. I like putting your mouth where your money is here, or putting your money where your mouth is.
Oh, Dan Springer.
Dan Springer, coming on in a day. I appreciate you taking the time here, the CEO of DocuSign.